Thanks, Ross. I'm Nick. I'm an addict. For us addicts, just sitting up here for this long, waiting, and in the break, where I had nowhere to go, I was like that. I'd walk up there for a bit, and out there, and out the back, and then I felt a bit self-conscious, so I came back in, and I went and stood up there. With the gallery of voices inside from the room, saying everyone in the room's thinking, like, look at him now, he's scared, he's running out, he's hiding, he doesn't know a fucking thing. So the victory is staying here. Like the cat on the hot tin roof, the victory is being there and staying there. And that's the one thing I know about this. That's why I'm able to stand up here and do this. Is it doesn't matter what I say in here. I'm an addict. I haven't got to talk about a specialist subject. I've got to talk about recovery, what happened, how I got here, and how I've stayed here. And it's the fucking... I'll try not to swear after this, right? I'll try and work on that. That's probably dishonest, isn't it? The therapeutic value, it mentioned the therapeutic value of one addict helping another. And I looked around this room and I just did a kind of rough head count. There's like, I don't know, something like 140 people in this room. It's a lot of addicts. And that power and that kind of scrutiny and that experience and that knowledge and that willingness to show up, I honour that. And that's why I come here. It's the one place I can make eye contact with my fellow human beings and know that you've shared the same experience with me, right? Okay, I was just bordering on pomposity then. I was just about to move into a kind of invasion of Poland speech, but I won't do that. I'll tell you what happened tonight. I came down here, I work in treatment, so I came down from Earl's Court and I was kind of lingering about in the office and I came out and just as I was walking out the door of the office, there was no one else there. And the signing out book was there. And it was, whatever it was, 5:45. And I thought, shall I put 6 o'clock? Or shall I put 6? And in a sense, it's not a great spiritual example. But I stopped myself and I thought, no, put 5:45. And sure as clockwork, when I was sitting down here before, I thought, I've got no shadows, just check. You know, you check the thing and you remember some terrible thing you've done on the way here. And I remembered that, actually writing down the kind of correct times left away. So just on a purely pragmatic, selfish basis, this stuff works, you know. But there's a part of me is frightened that there's a lack in the universe and I won't get my needs met unless I steal them. And a lot of this recovery lark, and whenever I've not surrendered to that, whenever I've actually done that kind of step three thing, we were talking about it in the break time, and I've handed over, my needs have been met. Whenever I've tried to take control, it's been hell. I started treatment for Hep C a few weeks ago, so I started on interferon. Now, I've wrestled with this for years and years, and I've equivocated around treatment and the need for treatment, and I've done Chinese herbs and milk thistle and danced and qigong and all kinds of things, right? And the virus has stayed, right, and it's advanced, despite all my stuff. And what happened was they gave me a call September and said I'd finally qualified for combination therapy, but there was a new trial starting. Would I elect to go on the trial? Would I be interested in doing this trial? And I checked it out with someone in the fellowship and they said, if it's what we think it is, go for it. The results have been thrilling in the States. I've got this particularly resistant genotype 1B, which a lot of us have got in the fellowship. There's no big deal about this. But the reality is there's often a struggle to clear it with conventional therapy. So I had a 75% chance of getting the new drug and you know, 25% chance of getting the placebo. The worst possible outcome was I got conventional treatment, standard of care treatment. So I went for it, and I walked in. And it's one of those things where I just surrendered. I had to have another biopsy. I've had two already. The biopsy was horrendous. You know, as soon as the doctor came in the room, I was up in the Royal Free on the 12th floor. I'm on my side, so I'm not there in my power like this where I can speak and cajole the guy or win him over or take him hostage. I'm sort of on my side in some weak, horrible gown on, you know, with stripes and a frilly coat. I didn't have that on. I wouldn't refuse to wear it. It was one of those ones where... And the guy came in and he was pissed off with the doctor when he was... You know those people who come in and they're kind of a little bit dyspraxic. He couldn't get the trolley down the end of the bed and then he couldn't elevate the bed and... He said, oh, it won't be okay. And I said to him, I'm terrified, you know, kind of apologetically. And he ignored me. I just felt, you know that thing where your heart sinks when someone doesn't actually connect with you. And I just had that sense, you know, when you watch someone go up to take a penalty and you can tell by their demeanor, it isn't going to happen. And I just thought, and of course, you know that sensation when you've done so much coke, you can hardly move the plunger on the works, it's like slush. And when you get it in, there's a moment when the universe pauses in its path. Planets stop in their path and there's a stillness. And you think, is that in? Did I miss? Did I get it? And you got it in. And you smell something from afar and you nearly like bugles a herald of something approaching from a long way away, back in time and space. But that's sometimes how I feel when I'm sitting here. I have that same sort of ale. And you expect some sort of many-headed hydra to appear in some bugled fanfare. That's the part where I jumped out the window with my underpants on, with a pair of these tight 70s Bly nylon underpants. Jumped out of the first floor window, ran across the thing in front of the flats, stole a bottle of milk off the milkman's float as he was delivering, you know, with his white thing on and all that. Drank the milk in the street, put it down, went, ooh. He just ignored me and drove off in his milk float and went back in the house. You know, where someone says, what's it like? And there are no adjectives. It's not like, is it good? Or it's beyond that. It's in some other, it's some Nietzschean beyond good and evil fucking world where there's three suns circling around and you're there. You've grown big long ears and a big kind of crocodilian sort of. Help me. So that's to explain the dryness. So the guy did the biopsy, right? As soon as he went in, I got this real wackeroony pain and felt this nausea sweeping over me. I've had two others and they were fine, right? And I knew he'd blown it. And even the research was there, head of the research was there. She said, he's got it, he's done it. And I knew he hadn't. I knew it was a fuck-up. And then the guy was fumbling and humming and hard, and he said, I've got to go again. And the second time when he went in, it was like being stabbed. It was a full outside, you know, it was one of those on the street, lying, and he said, oh no, mother, where nothing can help you. And I felt my kind of blood pressure go through the floor. And the guy was trying to get a cannula on me to get a tourniquet on me to get a cannula into me. And I just knew after seeing this guy's performance with the biopsy, right? This guy was not, with my blood pressure through the floor, there was very little, the prognosis was unfavourable for this guy to get a fucking line, you know, and start pumping fluids into me. And at the same time, it coincided, this is what they call in literature a pathetic fallacy. At the same time, right, it was 11:20 or 11:15 that day of the tornado. So I was watching this huge pillars of sort of darkness gathering over Parliament Hill Fields just outside the Royal Free, and things flying past the window, you know, deck chairs and leaves and branches, and there was a line on my side, and as the world was just turning black and I was fading away, and I thought, so this is it, this is the final fucking. They'll say, he was okay, wasn't he? Go, well, actually, he died miserably, clenched over in a fetal position, with nobody there. So anyway, I started the treatments. I'll get out this out the way quick, because it's kind of, I believe everything feeds in to the recovery bit. Do you know what I mean? It's that you don't need to sit down and do some linear, separate thing. This is, Mayor Barber was once asked, what is God? And Mayor Barber said, what is not God? There ain't no duality. It's all part of the fucking deal. I don't know if I believe what I've just said, but anyway, I'm sticking. So I started this treatment. I had my first injection of interferon, and left the hospital and started feeling this flu banging in, and you know, and all those things people fear, and the people in the hospital saying, you know, you have these side effects now. But they underestimate addicts. For people like me, walking along the street and suddenly having something happening, you know, like some kind of flu type stretching and withdrawal thing, was a real result. You know, I felt like exciting. I rang my sponsor and told him, he said, so you're finally comfortable in your skin after all these years, you're finally, after all this work, you finally found a place. I got home, took two paracetamol, and I was fine, and I've been fine since. And so it's been something about, this thing has hovered over me for years. And this new drug, and you know, this it appears on paper that this new drug eradicates the virus in 4 days, 8 days. I mean, it's insane, right? I was supposed to do a year on combination therapy. Instead, I'm doing 12 weeks of this thing. So forgive me if it's kind of off the thing, but I'm very excited about it. And who knows what's going to happen. But just for today, it feels that exciting. And that kind of just happened to me. And I've tried to manage the thing in the past and it never works. And this just came out the blue, you know. I had tax bill for January and that's hovered over me. And when it came in my own unmanageability, it was pennies. And I'd paid most of it anyway and I hadn't even realised I'd done it. So the reason I'm saying this stuff is that my unmanageability has caused me terrible grief in recovery. you know, I struggle with papers around the flat, and I hoard things, and I find real difficulty laying my hands on things. In my job, I'm kind of good at this part of it. I'm good at, you know, engaging with people and stuff like that. But going away and writing notes about it, I find absolutely excruciating. You know, it's just, I just find it extremely difficult to move from this place into the other. So it's been, that's been the real humbling plod in recovery for me, is doing things sequentially. Sitting down and doing a written step one. Because I've learned over the years, the thing that matters with this is giving the detail. It's fine to sit up here and say, oh yeah, I use drugs like you use drugs, it's all the same, and da-da-da and all that. That's general, universalized speak. What I've learned is, as soon as someone sits down in front of me and says, on the 17th of September, I left my kids in the house, I went to school, and I was supposed to pick them up from nursery, or I was supposed to take them somewhere, and I was 8 hours school, and just left them, and I just went into denial about it and all that, and I feel deeply ashamed of that, right? That's when I wake up. And that kind of autobiography is what wakes me up. So I made that one up. But my memory of my using, the last few years of my using, was things like pushing my kids in a double push chair along Tolloway Road through snow, leaving them with anyone who came round to the flat, whatever. Murderers on the run from Liverpool a couple of times, armed robbers, anyone who wanted to score and had the money to send me out to get anything from a £5 bag to whatever, you know. But mostly around a quarter of a gram, £5 bag, £10 bag mark. And my using at the end, I used to say, when I went into treatment, they said, what was your drugs of choice? And I said, heroin and cocaine. I wish. No, it wasn't. The last few years of my using in London was codeine linters, got on credit from the chemist. I used to run up a really big drug debt, man, of £8, 17 and 6 to be paid on Saturday morning. Cyclozine, travel sickness tablets, because they were a bit like Dicanol if you banged them in with a couple of amps or stuff like that. So that was the level of using, but occasionally, you know, some special brew or something like that thrown in for the mix, and occasionally gear. But I have to say, near the end of my using, I didn't even like heroin anymore, because I withdrew so quickly and got off so little. It was one of those things where the only thing that still worked was the withdrawals. That could always be relied upon. But the actual buzz, even when my pupils were pinned and all that, it was like the denial was over. It was threadbare. And I still felt. And near the end of my using, I used to walk around Finsbury Park. I'd have a Walkman on mended with sellotape. I'd have something like Talking Heads or some rhythmic sort of insectoid madness going, pumping through these headphones. I'd be walking along thinking, isn't it great being young, single and free, you know, and about 17? Someone said, you're fucking 36, you're ugly looking. Really, really henched, man. Really ripped, really kind of tight, you know, physique. I was like a pipe cleaner, you know, with like years of industrial amphetamine. This kind of, where you've got that good cat's piss, ammonia, North London smell. I said to someone once when I scored, I said, you know the way we smell when we're withdrawing? But when we score, we don't smell anymore. Is that because we don't? Or is it because we don't care anymore? And he went, no, it's because we don't. Isn't it amazing, the innocence of the information I've taken from people in using, the kind of people I've gone to for it. You know, that people who say, oh yeah, we used to use in our groin. And I remember this guy in Liverpool saying to me, Scott Ian, he said, it's all right. He said, if your balls swell up, it's okay. The scrotum just goes like a walnut and drops off and sheds a skin. It's good for you, man. Oh, that's okay then. This is the same guy who told me, I could feel this citric ripping through my veins. To that point where you can feel every part of your body, every sort of fibrous, fucking thrombosed bit. So it gets to the elbows, you can straighten your arm. And you've got some scientifically minded person saying, veins have no nerve endings, man. You're like that. Your arm's like an electric bush ablaze, you know, like some biblical transformation. He was the guy who said, it's good for you. It's scouring our veins out. Normal people will be dead soon, but we won't. We'll live forever. We're henched, we're honed, we're reamed out. We're like sports cars. I tell you what, I can't believe that I can be just the hospital stuff. The last thing I'll mention and all that, but I'm 55. I'm in good health, you know, the EPSI. I've got all my fingers and toes and all that. One of my sons is in recovery. He's over a year clean, and that's been a real joy. I've watched my sons outgrow me intellectually, physically. I've watched myself become a social embarrassment to them, and that feels really good too. And I sometimes stand in that world that I've somehow found myself with my wife. I've been married for 28 years, and I've had, you know, I was off having an affair for years. She kicked me out, rightly, and that was the second kind of big rock bottom for me. Just like the Walkman and the walking down Finsbury Park, because that last, you know, I can make jokes about it, but the real essence of it was like some kind of circle of the inferno. It was walking along, and I used to have that thing where I'd think, that coke I just scored, did I put it in this pocket, or did I put it in the line of my Levi's in that bit there, or did I put it there, or did I put it, where did I put that weed? So I'd check as I was walking along by Finsbury Park there, and I'd think, did anyone see me when I did that? So I'd do some balletic pirouette as I was walking along to check, and I'd do something else, think, did I just drop that? So it was like that unmanageability that's just some kind of, you know, when you see people with trolleys, supermarket trolleys, with their unconscious sort of, somehow kind of, some metaphor for the unconscious where they've got this huge pile of things they've collected for the last 2,000 years or something. I was just on the verge of moving into that territory, taking stuff out of skips, I took home a carpet once. It was a Caucasian carpet, it turned out, and I got £110 for it. So after that, I was in those skips, mate. I was taking used engine oil. If that was worth £110, fucking hell, post office wire. What will this be worth? It's much brighter, you know? So the house was full near the end of polystyrene and bits of rubbish and all kinds of things like that. Anyway, enough of that. I went to a meeting eventually in sometime in 1988. And what happened was my second son, who's now in recovery, when he was born, he went into distress at birth, and he was detoxed from methadone addiction. And it broke my wife's denial. And she was never happy using again. And that was in 1981, sorry, my second son. And she went to NA then, somewhere like 83. I think it was Dawn or somewhere like that. So it was a long, long time ago. And came back and told me about it, and we didn't quite get it, and she didn't really get it. But she was desperate to stop using and was looking for a solution. And that's when I went into that kind of the speed stuff and the mad and the codeine linctus and all the rest of it. But it was a slow attrition. It wasn't even romantic anymore. Not that it ever had been, but you know what I mean? It wasn't like I was moving toward, it was this slow move to some miserable, where death wouldn't have even been an event. It would just would have been some kind of dissolution, where they go, oh, are you coming with us? Oh, he's dead. How long has that been? Fucking months, you know? You still do walk, doing some mechanical, you know? So I had absolutely no hope. And I remember those moments of lucidity when I was walking along, in sort of possessed by demons. And suddenly having that moment of lucidity where I'd realised that, because before that I remember saying to a guy in Liverpool, these people around here, you know, we were walking through speakers somewhere, I wish it was like them, they're normal, they had pushchairs and all that, and people going to work and stuff like that, and the guy with me went, damn, he said, they're fucking scum, man. He said, they're just scum, look at them, they've got no purpose in life, not like us, we're addicts, you know, we get scripts and all that. He said, they look up to us. It's probably true in speak in Liverpool, but no, it's not. But I'd have those moments of lucidity where I'd realise that it wasn't a joke, that I'd been there a long time in that enchanted world, that I wasn't 17, I was actually in my 30s, and it wasn't going to stop. And I'd been there for 20 years, and nothing had changed. And there was no possibility from there of entering into life. I was always in that spectator role. Always threatening to do something. I'd started jobs enthusiastically over the years. I'd last a couple of months, you know. I have a great uncle, and my mother used to talk about this great uncle or great great uncle we've got. Who used to come into the house, and he'd say, when they talk about the family illness, and he used to say, he'd always just started a new job, you know, and he'd start a new job in a warehouse or somewhere or other, and the boss had come over to him. Inevitably, this would always happen, and say, now listen here, now look here, Hawkins, these are the fellows, they're good-hearted enough, you know, and they do their best. But you, I've been watching you. From now on, you're in charge, but don't tell anybody. And there's no extra money involved. But keep it under your hat for now. 2 weeks later, he'd get the sack. Now, this would happen again and again and again, and he'd have this eternal optimism, and then he was going to marry some woman who had a pub or had money, and she was desperate to marry him, and then he wouldn't mention it again 2 weeks later. So it's kind of like this stuff goes way back, that, you know, repeating the same behaviour and expecting different results. And somehow, the miracle was, my wife went to a meeting, and then she went to another one, and she used, and then she didn't use, and then she got a few days clean, and then she stopped using codeine, and suddenly she had 30 days. And I went to a meeting simply to kind of placate her. Went to this first meeting in some basement in Stoke Newington. I was on a methadone script. When we came out of the meeting, I went and bought a can of special brew, and somebody said, you don't need to do that or you'll die, you know. And I thought they're a bit melodramatic, these people. I just didn't, you know, I just thought. And I realised they were very ill. I was okay, you know. At this time, I had my head shaved. I had all my eyebrows plucked out. That was the project for the night when I was speeding. I think I'll pull all my eyebrows out. Is that a blackhead or is it a tear duct? You know, those kind of awful projects. If I had a Stanley knife and just moved my nose slightly, I'd be quite good looking, you know. That stuff where you're just on the verge of sort of moving into the politics of the body with a vengeance. You're trying to get the tools set out. I went to this first meeting. I came away. What I learned there was, despite my arrogance and my prejudgment about everything, and the people who came here, they're not addicts anyway and all the rest of it, and at the same time, the coexisting belief with that was that I wasn't an addict either. I could say it in doctor's surgeries when I was after Dicanol. I'd go in there and say, I've had this terrible migraine, doctor. He'd say, you sure? I'd say, well, backache, something like that, or migraine. He'd say, well, here's some Migraleave, or here's... I'd go, oh, no, I think there was something else that was given before that. I can't remember the name of it. I think it was Dicanol. It was, he'd go, no, I don't think I know that. I'd go, no, you do. I think it contains this. And I think 50 or 60 of them might do the trick. And having the guy say, you're an addict, get out or I'll call the police. And I go, you're right, doctor, you've seen through my, you know, and this causes me great shame, but I guarantee I am an addict, one of those poor souls wandering like a leper through. But if you could just see your way clear to give me this script, it doesn't have to be 60, it could be less, half of that. I'll never darken your door again. And you'd see the guy break, you'd see this man of letters, this good man, this philanthropist, you'd see his shoulders come down because the addict was just too powerful for him. Now, cunning, baffling, full on, 12 bore, full choke, bang. And I'd say to him as I was leaving the room, I'd say, you'll not see me again. He'd just be like, go, please. Next Tuesday, I'd be back there. I know I said, I was moving away to Scotland, but I've decided against it. I went to this meeting. I went to a number of meetings like that, and somebody explained to me, to stop using, you have to stop using, right? And I said, you don't understand, right? I knew they were wrong, because I said, look, what you don't understand is that if I don't take this methadone, I can't come here, because this methadone, not many people know this, but physicists have discovered, this methadone is the molecular glue that holds my body together. So if I don't take this methadone, I'll just fall apart. I'll cease to be. And underneath that was the belief that without drugs, I was nothing. My only existence was there. That's where I happened. That's where I became human, for want of a better word. And eventually I went to treatment. I had an 8-day detox after all those years. And I remember that first day I was clean, actually being in there and feeling okay. And then that was the first day. Upon the second day, when I was starting to get sweaty and my pupils were opening up and grabbing light and I was kind of panicked and anxious and all that, suddenly I was dressed and I was out the door. I went to the, somebody persuaded me to go back, the doctor saw me, and I moved then. That's when the kind of, the cunning and baffling bit, you know, that sort of wonderful, affable character, but once nobody paid any attention to the wonderful, affable character, saying, please doctor, I just need, you know, suddenly the fucking demon came out and I was kicking the door and shouting and banging, and I was saying, you don't understand, if I don't get this, I'll spontaneously combust, I have to have this. Something, I didn't care what it was, Largactyl, anything. I needed something to quench that fire. And somehow they held that boundary. But then what they did, because I was still on my way out, they got another guy in there who was 3 weeks clean. And he came, spoke to me and asked me what was happening. And I said, okay, I feel really panicky. I can't, I've got to get out. I'm on fire, right? That was my particular thing, was I used to sweat just one side of my head. I'd actually get deodorants, that horrible powder deodorants. I drove an ambulance for a while for Islington Council. And I can't think, you know, when you go into a straight environment and everyone there, you just feel so martially remote from them. In that they've got their kind of worries and their stuff, but you're in hell, just withdrawing on a Monday morning, and you're not going to get paid till Wednesday or something. I remember spraying the side of my head with this kind of encrusted sort of white thing to stop the kind of embarrassment of this sweat dripping off my forehead as it was on my time sheet, it was taught. Yeah, what the guy said to me, this guy in treatment who was 3 weeks clean, he said, yeah, he said, the same thing happened to me 3 weeks ago. And in that moment, right, what I was aware of was not what he was saying about the withdrawals or anything else, but what I was aware of was that he was still there, right? And from that moment, my obsession was broken. I didn't stop withdrawing. I did stop withdrawing. And then I didn't. And then I did. And it was intermittent. And it went on like that for another 18 months. I'd have times when I felt like I was withdrawing from methadone. But it never held me in its thrall again. And I went down on my hands and knees. There was a chapel, disused chapel in the basement of this place. And I went down and I prayed. I prayed when that obsession came back for that to be taken away. And I'd never known that happen before. I'd always used, whatever, however trivial it was what I used, whether it was a can of beer or codeine or gear, I always used. Even when I was clean for a week or so and I'd embraced all kinds of things I did in the 70s, I'd gone off and I'd been initiated and done all kinds of hippiedom and really wanted it and didn't want to use. And wanted to, you know, wanted to live and blossom and be, you know, and be there for my sons and my wife and be real. And it always got in the way, that addiction. And I never believed I could be free of it. Yeah. And I remember the excitement in that treatment centre of realising I could actually be there and be comfortable with all the physical discomfort. And that was 18 years ago. That was September 88. And my experience of recovery since then, and I've had a lot of pain in recovery, I've been the author of my pain in recovery. I've been the author of my own kind of discontents and my own problems. And I've survived those things, but I've had to show up, you know. I did a step 4 and 5 in treatment. And I remember that kind of thing. You know, you'd see people that'd be writing stuff down and everyone else seemed more methodical and more able than me. And I've realized that that's a myth. You know, other people's outsides do not necessarily match my insides. And that goes for all of us, you know. And I realized somewhere along the line, it took me so long to realize it, that the victory is being here and staying here. The victory is me not taking my will back and deciding to try and fix it or get involved with it. Just do the suggestions. My first sponsor said to me, if someone asks you to do a chair, you don't debate whether it's your ego or anything like that. If you're physically available, you do it. If you're not, you don't. It's that simple. If you're asked to do service, you just say yes, right? And there's times when I've said no, and that's felt okay too. That's felt okay. And this program for me, I've done, at the moment I'm on step 9, and I've worked through the steps in different ways over the years. And what I do with sponsees, and what I've learned, because you know what we're like, we're complex people. We go off on tangents and it can be everything from inner child work to family of origin to gestalt to all kinds of, there's all kinds of, I used to ring my sponsor, my first sponsor. I used to ring him like 3 times a day and I was about 3 months clean and I'd say to him, I'd ring and I'm hopeless. And he'd say, what is it? I'd say, well, the cat litter tray, you know. I can't, till I've done the cat litter tray, I can't do the other stuff. And the list was like something out of some Aegean stable type list of Greek, you know, tasks to perform. And he'd say, have you had the wash? And I'd say, oh, that won't help. This is a deep existential angst. There was a guy in a fella, I shouldn't really say this, but I'm going to anyway. There was a guy, when I worked in the prisons in Downview, we had like what they call a pre-admission, which is all the guys who were just coming in and they're half using and half not, and some of them want it and some of them don't and all that. But it was a big kind of Wild West mob, right? And this guy in the fellowship who'd gone off on one of these esoteric sort of gestalt or something like that, and this is no put down of any of the stuff, but he'd gone off and he'd learnt about existentialism and gestalt. So when he came in, he was in front of all these guys and one of them said, what are you here for like that? And he said, I'm here to help you make sense of the essential meaningless of your lives. And this big guy at the back just shouted, speak for yourself, you cunt, like that. And everyone went, hey! And he was vanquished. He went, they're not worthy of my wisdom. And some of those guys I still see around today. So, I've forgotten what I was talking about. But that first, I'm saying this because my belief is it doesn't matter how you do this stuff. It matters that you attempt to be open-minded, honest, and willing. And what happened was my first step 4 and 5 in treatment was just a kind of, it was the stuff that crippled me. It was the stuff I'd walk along the road and the sun's shining and I'd remember some terrible sexual event and I'd just be, it'd be like someone punching me in there and I'd go, oh no, I did that. And I'd be, and that shame and that, And that was the stuff, I just splurged it out. The guy he got was someone, he wasn't some big trusted whatever, he was a guy from AA, they just bust into the treatment centre. And it worked, that's what I'm saying. So it's kind of means and expediency and all the rest of it. And I believe that's the way this thing does work. It's not about getting it right. You know, this is work in progress. And we keep doing this stuff. It's like plate spinning. You get it going and you go back to step one and you do a bit more and that. Sometimes I hand over, sometimes I don't. And I suffer accordingly when I don't. But what I've learned in the midst of it all is that to this day, and it's taken a long time coming, is I'm okay. I'm innocent. I'm a good man. I'm good with my sons. And I've had all kinds of experiences. It's easy to be serene in isolation in some Himalaya somewhere. And easy then to be kind of rarefied and spiritual. But as we all know, you know, engaging with life is a challenge. And my stuff will come up. And my history. I find intimacy very difficult and very challenging. But it's also, it keeps me alive. That's the thing that lights me up. You know, that's the thing that lights me up. I had a scene today where the manager where I work said there, something about me, some kind of comment and all that, and I was raging immediately. You know, I went off, I was hurt, I was raging, and I thought, I want to go up and tell him. Does he know who I am, right? And thank God, there was that intervention where I didn't go immediately, right? And I've learned, never ever react in the moment. When a guy told me early on in the fellowship, he said, when you do that, it's inevitably disastrous. And that's been my experience. If I'm hot, I cannot engage with anyone. You know, because however logical I disguise it, do you know what I mean? I always go, yes, but you were, and it'll change, you know. So I went and saw him when I'd cooled down, and even as I was walking up there, my rage dissipated. So by the time I got to the guy's office, instead of going in there and saying, listen, I went in there and I thought, what am I actually feeling underneath my rage and my attack and blame and my pride is what I feel is hurt. I feel untrusted, just like when I was a kid and da-da-da and all that. I feel wrong. And that's my stuff. That wasn't anything to do with what the guy said. What the guy had said was quite sensible and you know, trivial. And I went into him, and that's what I said to him. I said, I just feel hurt and all that. And immediately, as soon as I've done that with somebody, they immediately want to come towards me, and I want to go towards them. And that's been my experience, is when I show up here, people come towards me. When I'm in my pride, people don't want to come near, you know. When I've got everything sorted out, it's not particularly prepossessing. You know, when I'm in mask, you know. But I've learned that this is a safe place to actually open that, let that fall down that trapdoor and drop back into that place of pain and be seen. And I think the most exciting thing in this life is to be seen and to see others. Breathe that one in. Yeah, can you feel it? Now when I sit on my own in an empty room, it doesn't feel like this. There's something we do here when we're gathered like this that is magical and it's priceless. And in these rooms, people heal. Whatever the words, whatever the content, we do the stuff, we do the steps, we get a sponsor, talk to the newcomer. As soon as I do a bit of service, I'm no longer self-obsessed because I'm outside of myself. It's the only thing I know that sorts me out. I cannot sort myself out in that way. And it's almost beyond words for me, but I have changed through coming to these rooms, and I've never, you know, I've done it slowly. I've often felt in the wrong. I've felt I've done the steps wrong, and I thought, okay, of course I must have grown since I did this last year. Do you remember that? He had to get me in a headlock practically to stop me. I kept saying, I just want to tell them this. One of those. Hang on, you know that person you're trapped in the bathroom with. Hang on. I remember when I first came to London, this is about 1970, right? I was in the Temple Club in Soho, and we'd taken some of these purple hearts, and I suddenly found, you know, one of those conversations where you're with someone, he was showing me a picture of Jesus, you know, some sort of awful, kind of nasty, kitsch sort of picture with a crown of thorns, and he was saying, explaining it to me, and he was wonderful, he was like an angel, the guy, and there was other people gathered around, and I realised I was in this elected company of kind of angels and beings from another plane. But then the dawn broke in, and slowly the speed faded away. And you know, when you wake up and you realize you're eating rubbish and you're lying down, you've actually sort of, you've half transformed into some kind of moth, you know, you're in some chitinous sort of, and the guy talking to you has got a beak, you know, some sort of, he's holding up some sort of pornographic religious image. Well, this, the feel-good factor I get from here It doesn't, it's not transient. It comes and it goes. And things, I walked down here tonight, I was early, so I went into the National Portrait Gallery, and I just heard this wonderful voice. I walked down the corner, and there was a woman with a trio singing. She was singing something like that old feeling, and it was just that, you know, those wild, good kind of Cole Porter songs, whatever it was, with this great voice and a great trio and all that, and it just set me up. And then I did 5 minutes of that, and then I came out of there, I prayed and walked over here. And on a good day now, I am unafraid. And that's what I've got from you guys. And, you know, over and over again, when I go to other places where they're not like us and they don't have this thing, I feel the power of these rooms is with me, you know, and it carries me. And I'm okay. And I can be part of the human race rather than special and different and all that. I'll leave it there. Thank you.